This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry, here with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
We're recording before the close today on Friday, June 17th. We have to give our team time to put things together behind the scenes before the long weekend, and we didn't want to work in late in the afternoon.
Yeah, Juneteenth, our newest federal holiday, second year in a row now, and this is the first year that the NYC is employing a day off for in recognition of that holiday. So given that it's the newest holiday, as we said last year, perhaps it's, if you're not familiar with it, it's worth reading into and understanding the significance behind it.
Yes. You would have thought it's a good time too. You know, you got a couple weeks after Memorial Day, a couple weeks before the Independence Day holiday. Makes the early summer go by a little bit faster.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like the, with Memorial Day marking the three kind of successive back-to-back federal holidays, it's kind of like reminiscent of Thanksgiving, right? Where it just speeds things through, through that the next few months.
Yeah, and definitely could have used that, could have used the speeding by this week, because it seemed like it was a very, very long week, given the markets and nowhere, as we were talking about before, nowhere to hide this week. So why don't we get into where are we?
Yeah, this is truly a nowhere to hide type of week across pretty much all measures here. Starting out with the S&P 500, and I will note, I can't remember if you said it right, but we are recording early. So at the time it's recording, somewhere around 10 a.m. Pacific time, the S&P 500 is down almost 6% on a week-to-date basis, month-to-date down almost 11%, and year-to-date it's down over 22%. The worst performer on the week was the energy sector, down almost 18% right now, which is huge. I mean, that's just very significant, but it's still not only leading the way on a year-to-date basis, but it is now also the only positive sector within the S&P 500, up 33% year-to-date. Bringing up the other end on the week-to-date basis is healthcare, which is down 4%. Everything is in the red, which is in line with our theme of nowhere to hide here. So pretty much the best performer down 4% on the week, worst performer down 18%. Moving over to other broad U.S. equity indices here, the Russell 1000 for the large representative of the large caps is down 6%. Small caps through the Russell 2000 is down 7.5%. Russell 1000 growth is down 5%, and the 1000 value is down 6.75%. And those are all the last few that I rattled off. They're all on a week to date basis. They're all firmly, I guess, as we would expect, negative there, with the best performer on the relative basis being the Russell 1000 value index, down 15% year to date. Its counterpart in the growth side is the worst performer, down 30% year to date across all of these U.S.-based equity indices that we're looking at here. Moving on to fixed income land, also negative. Yields rose across the curve here. But, Jeff, if we're looking at it from this week-to-date basis relative to last Friday's close, it looks like a pretty quiet week. The two-year Treasury was up 8 basis points to close the week at 0.15%. But I was looking at the intra-week ranges that we saw as the two-year got as high as 3.45% yield on the two-year treasury note there this week. So to close now at 3.15, I mean, that's a huge move relative to that high that we saw intra-week. The five-year, or let's just move to the 10-year. 10-year is up 5 basis points to close the week at 3.21. That on the week, intra-week, got as high as 3.5%. The bond ended up 6 basis points to close with a yield of 3.26%, having touched intra-week the 3.47 yield on the 30-year Treasury bond there. So 3.26 on the is the closing yield for, or not the closing yield, but the yield that we're at right now for the 30-year Treasury.
And when you look at the curve, also, you know, the 10-year is the lowest point other than the 2-year on the curve. So at 3.21, you know, threes, fives, sevens, obviously the 20-year is a, you know, 25 basis points higher than the long bond, but everything's a 10-year is the lowest point. You're only, and I think I cut you off. You're probably about to talk about the 2-10 spread, but it, you know, we're at 6 basis points today. So a little bit of a move there. People were talking about how it did invert intraday. The 2-10 did invert intraday this week, but we didn't get any closes, I don't think, at an inversion point.
Yeah, but just because it touched intraday as well, I mean, I guess that's a cue for pundits to go out there and talk about whether or not the 2-10's inversion really means anything now that we're perhaps in the, or, you know, this time is different, you know, the whole this time is different argument. So, you know, perhaps we'll start seeing it next week, especially with the curve as tight as it is right now. One thing I also will note too is that last week we talked about the two-year treasury yield swing 25 basis points intraday, and just, you know, remarking about how big of a move that was on just an intraday swing. When I was looking at the highs that we had in yields across the curve this week, I saw that the twos, the tens, the 30-year bond all saw 25 basis point range within at least one trading this week. So perhaps 25 basis points is the new norm here, at least through the summer.
I hope not.
Yeah, I hope not. I mean, otherwise, these weeks are going to certainly drag on, right? Next week's four-day work week might feel like 6 days. So if we're lucky, I guess. Let's see here. Moving over to the U.S. or the Bloomberg U.S. bond market here, the bond aggregate, I should say, that's down 0.75 points on a week-to-date basis, down over 11% year-to-date. This week's weakness was led within the components of the aggregate by the agency mortgage-backed securities market, which is down about 1.25 points. On the week, IG corporate credit was the next worst performer, down about 0.75 points. And then treasuries were down about 40 basis points. Pretty much, again, nowhere to hide as the theme continues in the bond market. We saw EM down about 1.4%, bank loans down about 1.5%, and high yield corporate credit down almost 2% on the week-to-date basis. And everything here is in the red based on these indices that we look at. With bank loans being the best performer, down just over 5.5%. The worst performer here is emerging market sovereign, which is down about 20%. And then within the cohort that comprises the Bloomberg U.S. aggregate, it is and still is the IG corporate credit space, down over 15% year to date.
Yeah, high yield passed the magical 500 basis points in spread. I think today or yesterday. So, you know, that's the line where people start to maybe it looks attractive again from a high yield in total return standpoint. So it'll be interesting to see how that kind of shakes out next week as, you know, that 8.5 or so yield on the high yield index is starting to look like a real return.
Yeah. We'll see who comes out of the woodwork to pick up some of those bonds there. But I recall at the end of May, I want to say, it had gotten out as far as wide as 490, I believe, was kind of the high watermark for the recent levels there. And it did shift right back in on kind of a risk rally alongside equities right after that. So we'll see if the 500 is that kind of that magical line that people will start coming out for. And then moving over to the commodity market, no shelter here as well, at least on the aggregate index level as measured by the BCOM there. That was down, let's see here, almost just about 6% on a week-to-date basis. That brings it on a month-to-date basis down 3%. And if this continues, this negative sign in front of the month-to-date number, this will be the first time since November of last year that the BCOM has had a negative monthly print on a aggregate level there. So we'll be watching out for that. Right now, at least for this week, is pretty much broad-based weakness as well. There is a few of like maybe exactly a handful of sectors that are looking to be positive on the week-to-date basis out of around 23 commodities or so. The worst performer this week was natural gas, which is down about 20% week to date. But when we look at it on a year to date basis, it still looks like to be the best price performer on the front month contract for this commodity complex that we look at, up over 90% on a year to date basis. But we do have that, what we used to call heating oil, up almost at 88%, but that is actually now diesel, low sulfur. Diesel as is, but still has that heating oil moniker within the futures contract there. But nonetheless, perhaps a little bit too in the weeds there, but it's not much, many places to hide. Perhaps if you had picked out a couple of commodities, you might've had a little bit of a win here, but probably not enough to offset the rest of your portfolio.
I mean, even oil down big today, down to 110, WTI down to 110 a barrel, down from, it was over 120 last Friday, so a big move there.
Yeah. I saw something in the headlines this week with the EIA, Energy Institute of America, maybe. But either way, it's the government. It comes out of the Department of Energy. It's a sub-agency within there, talking about there was a unexpected 2 million barrel build in the inventories this week. But on the headline, on the surface, that looks very bearish with regards to energy in terms of the supply building there. But, you know, it drew some curiosity there. So, we've been talking about the strategic petroleum reserves over this, the last few episodes, ever since Biden talked about releasing 180 million barrels of oil from the strategic petroleum reserve over the next 6 months, about a million barrels a day. And that was announced back in March 31st of this year. So I looked at it and it looks like last week, the last 2 weeks actually were, they're kind of getting up to pace and then some. They've been releasing about a million barrels a day plus over the last 14 days. And that 2 million build that we had in the overall inventories did not, I guess overall is the wrong word, but the 2 million build that we had in inventories did not include that of the inventory within Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So part of that is likely coming from that 7 million draw from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve going into, making its way into the rest of the ex-SPR inventory levels. So some of that probably has to do with the build, at least there. It was that petroleum release.
Yeah.
So we'll see what that means for crude oil moving forward. But it does seem like the pipelines are starting to ramp up to at least around that 1 million barrels a day. We'll see if they can continue at that pace, because we had noted in the past, as well as the need for maintenance and being able to pump out or release the barrels from the SPR at a high level over a longer period of time. We weren't quite sure if that was going to be possible to maintain for the longer period of time. So that pretty much wraps up the financial part. Well, actually, with Bitcoin, I did mention Bitcoin already. So confusing myself there after I've rambled on about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve there. So Bitcoin is, I will note though, that it is just hovering it's found life around that 20,000 mark. So right now, it's about 20,500 per Bitcoin.
That's down 30% on the week. So a pretty big move there. I think that would be the worst performer on the week.
Yeah, down 56% year to date. So it's looking pretty bad there. But it's also pretty startling to note that Bitcoin is probably one of the best performing crypto asset or cryptocurrencies out there right now as well. So with that wrap up, do you want to kick us off on what happened on macro front?
Yeah, and to start off, it's not really a macro data point, but we did get a big market moving event kind of midday there on Monday. And it was when the Wall Street Journal posted a story from Nick Timiraos, who's the they're kind of their Fed guy, and people are people assume he's the mouthpiece of the Fed. But the story suggested that the Fed is likely to consider a 75 basis point move at the meeting the next day. On Friday, after the CPI report, the Wall Street Journal did post a story saying that the Fed was still on track for a 50 basis point move. So really, it was a big reversal, and some people were kind of discounting it. But really, the fact that it was from Timiraos, it really gave the story some credence that you know, he got the phone call and said, you know, the Fed's going to hike 75, and kind of prepped the market for it. And so, as you said earlier, Sam, you know, we had that 25 basis point move in the 2-year last Friday, we thought was a big move. We actually got a 29 basis point move on Monday, mostly on that story. We did get the WIRP function on Bloomberg talking about Fed funds futures. That moved the probability of a 75 basis point rate hike from 35% right before the story broke to 92%. And so like an hour later, I was at 92%. And you know, we'll talk about the Fed here in a little bit, but that that story did tend to prove out it was correct.
I was gonna say, it's always comforting to know that these government agencies are always willing and able to use these side channels to move, to move their communication around. So
it's in the blackout period, which we'll talk about that in the Fed's Q&A, but kind of interesting when you're in the blackout period, you can't give public comments, but you can, you know, give private comments that are kind of taken to be public comments.
Exactly. Always stretching the boundaries of the law are our lawmakers. Right? So
from the real macro side of things, on Tuesday, we did get the PPI number. They came in as expected at 0.8%. That brought the year-over-year number to 10.8. Faye from our macro team or our multi-asset team, he wrote in his piece that it suggests inflation has moderated from its peak back in March, but still suggests persistent underlying inflationary pressures. And I think we'll have to see how these numbers kind of go out into the PCE. That's released again in a couple of weeks, but it'll be interesting to see kind of how if that comes to pass. Then on Wednesday, we did get the retail sales number that fell 0.3% month over month in May. It was actually expected to rise 0.1%. So pretty big disappointment there. The ex-auto number was expected to rise 0.7%, but only rose 0.5%. So we started to see some softening there. It was kind of interesting. The biggest gain in the retail sales was in gasoline stations. So not something really where you want to see the biggest gains. Also on Wednesday, you did get the Fed. As I noted last week, the WIRP function showed there was an 18% chance of a 75 basis point hike and a 34% chance of a 75 basis point hike in July. And after the meeting, there was now a 75 basis point or 75% chance of a 75 basis point hike in July, and another 200 basis points priced in by year end. And there are 4 meetings left. So on average, the market's expecting 50 basis points every meeting. So if we get a 75 in July, maybe we'll be a 25 in December. And then this morning, we did get the leading index. That number fell 0.4%, which was as expected. The big negatives were consumer expectations, stock prices, and building permits. That brings the year-over-year number to 3.0%. And looking at the month-over-month numbers, it could take us another 3 or 4 months at this kind of negative 0.4 type month-over-month number to go from 3 to a negative number. So we don't have any huge numbers rolling off, but really looking at it and saying that when this number does go below zero, that is a good recessionary signal. So something that we're keeping an eye on. For our topic of the week, even though we are in the summer months, given that there was a Fed meeting, we're going to cover the Fed here. So the Fed did raise rates by 75 basis points to 1.5 to raise the Fed funds rate to the range of 1.5 to 1.75%. In the Q&A, Powell did kept on referring to it 1.6% as the Fed funds rate. So we can go with that as the level. The vote was 10-1 with Esther George dissenting. She was in favor of a 50 basis point rate hike. She did come out this morning and say that it was because of forward guidance, and she didn't think that she thought that the Fed had telegraphed a 50 basis point rate hike, and that they really should have stuck to that. Other than Powell or someone on the Fed giving the Wall Street Journal the heads up that 75 was likely to happen.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's a lot of chatter before leading up to it. I know in a couple of external calls, you know, we had people asking me the question and about credibility of the Fed. And, you know, I was watching Jeffrey talk on CNBC afterwards, and in the guests leading and preceding Jeffrey, you know, the question of credibility came up again. And you know, I think the idea of the credibility of Fed's forward guidance is definitely something, you know, that people like to talk about, but there's also the credibility of the Fed's ability to fight inflation. You know, so with this, I think perhaps, you know, 75 basis points kind of undermines that trust in forward-looking guidance outside of side channels, but it really puts a, you know, Jay's perhaps, you know, effort or commitment to fight inflation front and center, you know, which is something that he's talked about many times in the past, that the Fed has the tools to fight inflation, right? So, you know, perhaps you lose some credibility on the guidance, but you maintain a little bit of credibility on the inflation fighting front. You know, of course, people will question whether or not 75 basis points is enough. Why not 100? Why not 125 if you really think it's a big issue? But that credibility has been front and center as well as a topic of discussion around the Fed.
Yeah. And then, you know, you mentioned Jeffrey. He tweeted that, I think, the night before saying, hey, they should just raise it to 3% and see what happens.
Yeah.
If that's what they think the neutral rate is, why wait?
Correct. Especially, you know, why do incremental pain gradually over time, over the next, you know, four meetings or five meetings, I guess, at that point when we were talking about, or when he was talking about it, when you know that when it seems like the incoming economic data is only going to get weaker from here, why not just do it up front while it's the economy is still relatively strong to where we perhaps might be at the year end, you know, rather than just doing things over time and just, you know, having a little bit of a few cuts here and there.
But, yeah, I think, you know, that it's, you know, it just shows that the Fed doesn't know. They you know, we'll talk about the dot plot here in a second. But the Fed doesn't know where they need to be eventually to get inflation under control without harming the economy. So they kind of want to take it in baby steps so that they can pause or you know, then not necessarily cut rates, but they can pause or reduce the pace of interest rate hikes if they start to see some wobbling.
Yeah, and I saw that the 75 basis point rate hike is the first time we've done 75 basis points since 1994. So Powell is kind of in, I guess, you know, not uncharted, but somewhat, you know, relatively unique territory here with a 75 basis point hike here. But really, I mean, the Fed, if you think about it, ever since Volcker came out and crushed inflation, the Fed has really tried, you know, has built and has tried to maintain this reputation for being able to maintain price stability and, you know, keep inflation under check. You know, Volcker crushed that beast, and then, you know, each subsequent Fed chair has brought or basically maintained price stability every time it's kind of gotten out of whack. And so Powell perhaps is the first one that has faced or has, I don't know if we can really say that he's the one that created this inflation problem. It's probably been built over the last decade or so, but he's probably the first one that is really facing this this real inflation problem since Volcker. So we'll see how he handles it.
Yeah, I mean, he did mention in the Q&A that you know, many people are experiencing inflation for the first time because they haven't had any sort of, we haven't had this sort of inflation in 40 years.
Yeah.
So he is, you know, luckily for us, or, you know, for the country, you don't get this 8% or 8%+ inflation regularly.
Yeah. I mean, inflation definitely is the topic of conversation of late. That, and, you know, given my age, it's like, it's also about health and inflation seem to be the hot conversation topics lately.
Why don't we get into the dot plot there and see where the Fed members actually think things are going to shake out over the next couple of years?
Yeah. I mean, since it's June, we do get that the quarterly Fed's summary of economic projections, which we refer to as a SEP, or most people refer to as the DOTS, in addition to the rate decision. So this month's SEP, we did see a significant number of changes, the DOTS included there, but all of it pretty much reflects a deteriorating economic outlook, with the dot plot, the median expected Fed funds rate for year end 2022, it looks like it increased by 1.5 percentage points to 3.4. So that puts it in the lower and that upper bound of the target range between 350 and 325 and 350 there. The 2023 median increased by 1 percentage point to 3.8%, and the median dot there drops to 3.4% by 2024 again, so to match what we saw in 2022. So up and then it kind of peaks out in 2023, coming back down 2024 before the longer term, the longer run projected rate hits 2.5%. And that's, I should note there, that is the only projection on the longer run basis that changed versus the March SEP report. The inflation, unemployment, and the rest, and GDP all stayed the same. The median target, or the median projected rate for the Fed funds rate, was bumped up by 10 basis points to that 2.5%. And looking through the other projections here, the reason for that increase in the median dot was the increase in the outlook for inflation. So for 2022, headline PCE projections bumped up by 90 basis points to 5.2% there, while projections for core PCE were up 20 basis points to 4.3%. So that bigger move up in the headline is a nod to the commodity-driven headline component that's driving most of that pain there. And then when we look at projections for 2023 and 2024, headline PCE was up 10 basis points for both of those years, they're lower than what was indicated in the March summary of economic projections. And then 2023 core PCE increased by 10 basis points, while 2024 remained the same. And as I mentioned before, the longer run numbers for each of these other components remain the same. So for PCE, which is the headline component that they offer a projection for, that's expected to be at 2% year over year. No real surprise there. I mean, I guess we've talked about in the past that perhaps they should think about raising it a little bit, but it looks like they've been steadfast in trying to target that 2% year over year on the headline PCE basis. Relative to March, June's SEP also saw expectations for a slower economy over the next 3 years, in 2022 included, with real GDP projections dropping from 2.8% to 1.7% in 2022. 2023 is expected to drop by 50, or did drop versus the March SEP by 50 basis points to 1.7% year over year real, and a reduction of 10 basis points in 2024 to 1.9%. Longer run remains the same at 1.8% real GDP year over year. So it's overall a weaker economy projected for sure, but it does seem a little bit optimistic given the negative Q1 GDP print that we saw on the real basis. And GDP now is indicating pretty much a flat so far type of GDP for Q2. And then on the back of what looks to be weaker incoming economic data as well. So it does seem a little bit optimistic, but that said, the Fed projected 2022 real GDP of 1.7 looks to be, or is, lower than what the Bloomberg Economist forecast was at as of yesterday, which was 2.6%. So both of them, to me, seem to have a shade of optimism for 2022 on a real basis. I'm not talking about headline, which should overwhelm the components of GDP, but real GDP is still forecasted to be positive, at least for the year end of 2022 versus 2021.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, given the, you said GDP still being positive. That was one of the questions that Powell got. It was a I can't remember the exact question, but it was basically like, are you trying to induce a recession? It kind of tried to backdoor it wasn't a straightforward, like, are you trying to induce a recession? But it was like, you know, tried to, with the assumption that they were trying to induce a recession. And it was kind of a question, and Powell came out right away and was like, he said, we're not trying to induce a recession right now. Let's be clear about that. So he was very upfront about that. And he said, we're trying to achieve a 2% inflation consistent with a strong labor market. The SEP has inflation getting down to a little above 2% in 2024 with unemployment at 4.1%. So that's kind of their goal. 2% inflation, you know, 4.1% unemployment and no recession. So real, still trying to thread the needle there. Certainly I think that they think they can do it. They're pretty confident that they can do it. And I guess it would be scarier if they didn't think they could do it.
Yeah, you know, that answer also stuck out to me, you know, as well. I made a note here too that, when he was talking that, you know, he was defining, you know, the trying to reach that 2% inflation goal and being, you know, accepting of an increase of the unemployment rate, which seems pretty mild, right? I mean, I think, what are we at, 3.6 right now? And he's saying that it's going to get up to 4.1 by 2024, all at the same time when people are thinking about recession coming in between. But his focus on just those two components, inflation without damaging employment, he didn't mention the economy, right? He didn't say anything about the GDP at that time. So I guess it's kind of off the radar. And, you know, it's something that you and I have been talking about too. Just the focus has been on inflation and the strength of the labor market. So that's really kind of what he's thinking of, or either that he's just not bringing up. He's avoiding the economic contraction kind of part of the story.
And it's interesting, normally when I go through the Q&A, I kind of lump them together in topics, but this time there were no other topics other than inflation. And certainly everyone was asking a lot about why 75 basis points and the first question was really, did you back yourself into a corner last meeting and say, you know, 50 basis points over the next couple of meetings and enough to have to think about, leaking a story to get to the 75. And, you know, Powell, you know, as you would expect, was like, oh, no, you know, definitely we said we're going to be nimble. We're going to look at the data. We're going to be, he didn't really say data dependent. And he did say that, what are they going to do? Did they want to wait, you know, raise 50 basis points, talk up the probability of a 75 in 6 weeks? But they thought that they really wanted to front load it and really decided that 75 made sense. This week. The second question was like, why did you do 75 and not, why not 100? And as you said, Sam, why not 125? You could extrapolate that out. But they, you know, Powell did say, you know, they wanted to see declining monthly inflation ratings. And they actually thought that they would start to see signs of inflation flattening and ideally beginning to decline. And so because they didn't, because that CPI report came out last Friday and you actually saw it pick up, it kind of spooked them. And that's why they raised rates by 75 basis points. He did say that the next meeting can be a decision between 50 and 75. And at the end of July that would put them in a quote, more normal range. He said that's a desirable place to be. Because you have more optionality there. So, you know, he kind of didn't say, you know, from that being in a more normal range and being that's where you want to be, seems like you should have gotten there. Maybe you should have done 100 instead of 75, but certainly I think the market wasn't expecting a 75. So if actually they had raised 100, it really would have caused some panic in the stock market and in the bond market.
I guess it's one back to the old mantra of they need to hike enough now in order to have enough to cut later on when they need to in a gradually weakening economy.
Yeah, that was always the old one. We're going to raise rates so that we can cut them if things exactly. slow down.
Exactly.
The third question was really like, why are we, 4% is that's kind of where Fed funds futures are pricing in the terminal rate. The dots say 3.8 in 2023, end of 2023. is that how much of that is kind of a more normal level? And Powell really just said, we're going to find out empirically. We don't know. We're not going to be model driven. That's, you know, that's kind of why I think they're just kind of gradually hiking, because they don't know that, you know, a model would say, 3.8 is where we want to be. Why don't we get the 3.8 right now? But they don't have enough faith in that model or those numbers to say for sure that that's where they want to be. So they're going to do it empirically, do it in baby steps again, and just kind of see and react. He said they're going to keep their eyes open and react to incoming data, both on financial conditions and on what's happening in the economy. And that was really the only time he really mentioned much on the economy. And then the fourth question, and this is the last of one, and we'll go in chronological order. They were asking that, you know, why did they raise 75? What was it that really kind of spooked them? That was, the question was there something you saw that was unsettling enough to risk eroding the credibility of your verbal guidance by doing something so different from what you had socialized before? And I thought that was a perfect synopsis of the downside to raising 75. And, Powell did say the preliminary Michigan reading, so that's the University of Michigan 5 to 10 year inflation expectations survey. He said that reading was quite eye-catching, and you start to see a lot of the Twitter sphere use eye-catching as their phrase of the meeting. It's always last meeting was softish, this meeting was eye-catching, so they noticed that. Powell said they noticed that reading, and that the CPI report was higher, and so there was really those two pieces that really caused them to, or kind of spooked them, and kind of caused them to raise rates by 75 basis points. And I'm going to front run ourselves here, that we get the final University of Michigan inflation expectations next Friday. So we'll keep an eye on that and see if it goes above that 3.3% that was the preliminary number, or if it kind of comes back down and gives the Fed a little bit more pause, or maybe the Fed would hope that because they raised 75, that the inflation expectations would come down.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of big changes, I think, around the narrative, and then also obviously that we saw in the summary of economic projections really conveying what their changes are in terms of the way that they're thinking about it. One thing I did notice, and I wrote a note while he was talking, is it does seem like he has a different narrative around labor now. You know, in the past few pressers, he'd been talking about how the labor market was strong, the labor market was strong enough to withstand the changes in policy. But it seems like it went from being strong to a little bit too strong from the demand side. And he spent some time talking about that as well. And it seems like now they're willing to let labor suffer a little bit just to bring down that kind of that excess demand in for labor, and perhaps worried a little bit about wage growth, perhaps supporting this price inflation that we've seen.
Yeah, he did. When you're talking about unemployment, he said we're not looking to have a higher unemployment rate, but they are going to have a higher unemployment rate, right? He's like, we don't seek to put people out of work. Of course, we never think that too many people are working and fewer people need to have jobs, but we also think that you can't really have the kind of labor market that we want without price stability. And he's like, we want the labor market that we had before the pandemic. So, a lot of people out there, a lot of things out there are like, oh, we want to get back to where we were pre-pandemic.
That's right. So, I mean, there's a lot to pour over. I mean, if anyone ever had an interest in, perhaps watching one of these pressers, this would probably one for that would be recommended, at least in my book. You can always catch those replays on the YouTube and perhaps on the Fed Reserve site as well. So
yeah, and keep a note of like when he gets a question that he doesn't really have a straight answer to, he kind of just rambles and kind of loses focus, and it's not he kind of just talks through the ideas and doesn't really answer the question. And so it's something that you just, if you've listened to him enough, and you certainly, Sam, you and I have made an appointment viewing these days, it's kind of funny to just hear him not answer questions and just kind of spout numbers and not really kind of talk about both sides of his mouth, and then he just moves on to the next person.
Yeah, I guess he's taking cues from my book whenever I don't want to answer a question in life as well. So, although I'll say, at least I hope I don't, or I try very hard not to talk out of both sides of my mouth, but a little bit of hand waving here and there, you know, definitely goes a long way when you don't want to avoid a question.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Alan Greenspan was the master of that. I remember in grad school, you know, one of our econ professors, we just played a tape of Greenspan answering a question in front of Congress. And it was like, I have no idea. It sounded good, but he didn't say anything. And so maybe Powell's been listening to some or watching some Greenspan tape to get that.
Yeah, that was definitely back in the days when the Fed wasn't transparent, right? It wasn't until kind of Bernanke started becoming a little bit more transparent, and then Yellen, and then, you know, Powell is just, you know, just taking it to a whole new level. Especially, I mean, we're not used, you know, for Fed watchers that have been around for a while, you're not really used to seeing a chairperson coming out after each FOMC meeting to give a presser, right? I mean, back in the day, it was far and few between relative to what Powell is taking it to.
Right. And you so used to like really watch on the when the Fed chair would go in front of Congress, because that was one of the few times you heard them publicly speak. And now it's the presser is much more interesting than being in front of Congress.
That's right. That's right. And speaking of Congress, I did see that Powell is set to speak in front of the House and Senate next, I want to say Wednesday and Thursday. If not Wednesday and Thursday, perhaps it's Tuesday and Wednesday. But I do think it's Wednesday and Thursday. I think it's the House followed by the Senate.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that for everybody.
Yeah. Alongside that, next week, we've got on Thursday, we have the S&P Global Manufacturing PMI. I had to pause there for a minute. I guess that's the old market there with the June preliminary. The expectation is for it to be down from 57, and the expectation is for 56.3, still in expansionary territory, but down relative to what it had been previous. Also that day, we get the services PMI from also the old market with an I. The expectation is 53.7, but this time it's up, you know, relative to the previous print of 53.4. So that's kind of in line with what we've been seeing as well in terms of the way that we think about the back of the pandemic, where people were initially focused on the goods experience, and now they're moving up to the services experience now that they're let out of the house and can travel more freely than they had been in months past. So kind of in line with that, what we've been talking about there. And then finally on Friday, as you mentioned, we have the University of Michigan, the inflation expectations, the final ones relative to what we saw this week. And this week we saw the prelim of 3.3. Let's see if this revision and the final is still going to be eye-catching. You and I, in the past, we had kind of poo-pooed these surveys, you know, saying that it's not based on hard data. But I got to say, now that we just saw this big kind of move from forward-looking guidance to unexpected side-channel guidance with the changes to 75 basis points, and we know that that Powell did mention this report on expectations as well as the multi-decade or historical low in sentiment out of that same survey. We'll definitely be watching this one now as well.
I like that unexpected side channel.
Yeah, I guess it shouldn't be unexpected. Tim Rolls is the one that they say is the side piece there.
Yeah,
side piece.
The mouthpiece. Right,
the side mouthpiece.
That's right.
So yeah, so that's the things to keep an eye on next week. We'll stay tuned for that, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess that wraps it up for this week. Again, Sam, I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks, everyone, for sticking with us on Monday Morning Minutes. And if you're a new listener, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can pick us up each Monday before the bell on any of your favorite podcast platforms. If you have any problems finding it, if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for us, you can email us at minutes@doubleline.com or hit us up on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
You can find more information about DoubleLine at our website, doubleline.com. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/DoubleLineCapital, where you can see Jeffrey Gundlach's most recent webcast titled It's Not Unusual. Just drop the Jeffrey Gundlach interview on CNBC from post-Fed. And that one's titled Paint or Get Off the Ladder, which is, you know, is I usually think of a different different phrase for that kind of idea, but same idea, paint or get off the ladder. Don't forget to subscribe to Sam's other podcast, The Sherman Show. You can follow them on Twitter at Sherman Show Pod. Hope everyone has a great long weekend, and hopefully the short work week next week actually feels short.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone, and good luck out there.
Represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without express written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast and any liability therefor, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2021 DoubleLine Capital.